You know, parents at the birth of their first child are overjoyed. And I can still remember back to that experience. It's one of the most delightful times in life. And of course, you have a certain amount of trepidation, of course, as new parents. But as time goes on, as you get into that second year, as the infant turns into a toddler, you get to that stage of what they call the terrible twos. I don't know whether you have an experience of that, but a lot of people testify to this particular stage. We somehow managed to pretty well get round all that, I think. Probably the sort of stern look on our faces or something like that. Our children looked at us and figured out, nah, there's no point in going through the terrible twos. It will be terrible for me. But, you know, here we are, 2 years of this church. And in some ways, I suppose you could say we've been through the terrible twos. Let me say to you, at the start of last year, at the back of the start of January 2007, one of my prayers was, Lord, double our church. And the Lord said, fine, I'll halve it. And, you know, sometimes God does that, doesn't he, to you? But that doesn't mean to say that God has thereby halved the blessing, or halved the lessons, or halved the benefits in answering the prayer in that kind of a way. You may remember some time ago, 15 years in fact ago, when the Queen made a speech in which she described her year as the Annus Horribilis, that sort of terrible year. And in the year, three members of her family had gone through marriage breakup, and just to top it all, Windsor Castle caught fire. So yeah, not a very good year for the Queen, 1992, one that she would very much like to have sort of scrubbed out completely. And for us as a church, you know, I wouldn't like to scrub out 2007 as being, well, a pretty bad year, a bit of a bleak year, one I'm simply going to bury in the deepest sea and forget, because it's been a very useful year in many, many ways. This evening, and if you didn't catch the notices, we're going to be doing a little review in our evening service back at my house. We're going to do a review of 2007, so you'll be able to see some of the things God did do in that year, and maybe some of the lessons that perhaps we can be learning from that experience. So yes, sometimes as Christians we have to go into, if you like, climbing mode, where everything's going to be a little bit uphill and a little bit of a struggle is going to be involved. But it's not always bad. It's not always bad news. And of course, when you get to the top, the view is great and you're glad for all the effort you had to put in to get to that place. The story is told of Charles Darrow. And in 1928, that man found the love of his life, a girl called Esther. They married, and before they got married, he promised her one thing. He said, you know, darling, I am going to make you $1 million. He was an American, of course. And then the new year dawned, 1929, and if you know your history, that was the year of the Great Depression. They lost their jobs, they lost their cars, and finally, they lost their house. And for Charles, this was really almost all too much for him, and he could barely drag himself out of bed day after day. And so his wife thought to himself, you know, I need to do something, because things are really, really starting to head down sort of the plug hole. And so she said to her husband one evening over the meal table, so what are we going to do when we get our first million? What are we going to do with it? And she said, you know, we need to have plans. If our dream is going to come true, we need to have plans as to what we're going to do with it. And so they started to just chat about it and say, well, maybe we'll buy this and maybe we could buy that with it. And they found it was such fun that they decided to do the same the next night. And again, they would think of things they could buy, things they could do with that $1 million. And it was such fun doing this evening after evening. They started to make up money. And they started to have a board. They actually had a board. You know where this is going, don't you? This is the story of Monopoly, how that came about. But there's an interesting twist at the end of that story. He went to Parker Brothers and he sold the game to them. The price tag, guess what? $1 million. So yes, an interesting story. And perhaps an encouragement to us that things can look very, very bleak. And yet, something can be around the corner. I want this morning for us to look at some Christians that were going through a number of serious setbacks in their life. Serious setbacks. These are the Christians that this letter of the Hebrews is written to. We don't exactly know who they were. We don't exactly know who the writer of the letter was. But what we do know for certain is that they had some things they were really facing. And we're going to look at a passage which really gives some solid advice to people who are up against it in some ways. In some sense, they can say their back is against the wall. Let me paint in a little bit as to what was going on. There was a great temptation for these Christians here that were being written to slide backwards, to lose ground because of the suffering they were going through. And let me read you some verses later on in chapter 10, verses 32 to 34. It says this: "Remember those early days after you'd received the light, when you stood your ground in the great contest in the face of suffering. Sometimes you were publicly exposed to insult and persecution. At other times, you stood side by side with those who were so treated. You sympathised with those in prison and joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property because you knew that you yourselves had a better and lasting possessions." So that's pretty tough, isn't it? You can see they were really having quite a difficult time, really going through the mill. But not only that, you can also see in the letter that they were beginning to slide. Their grip was starting to be lost. And you can see that a number of places in the letter. It's not too difficult to pick it out, really. For example, chapter 2 and verse 1, "We must pay more careful attention, therefore, to what we have heard, so that we do not drift away." And we'll be seeing it later on here in chapter 10 and verse 25. "Let us not give up the meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing." All these signs of drift and slippage for these Christians. And for them, of course, there was a very easy sort of get out. And that was simply to go back to Judaism. Go back to the synagogue where things were generally tolerated and okay. So this morning what I want us to do is to look at these five statements in the verses that Hannah read to us earlier on this morning. Chapter 10, verses 19 through to 25. In that section, it's only seven verses, but we get five "let us" statements. And what I want to do, rather than taking all five as five separate ones, I want to group them together really under three headings. And the first is this heading of drawing near. One of the things we need to understand about the book of Hebrews is, like so many of the New Testament letters, they come in two halves. There is a sort of a theological start and then a practical end. And this is very, very true in many letters in the New Testament. Ephesians would be a good example. Three chapters of doctrine and then three chapters of, now you've heard the doctrine, let's work this out a bit. Let's put this into practice. How is this really going to work in your lives? There's no point in just having theology just so you've got it up here if you don't run it down into your heart and start to apply it. Of course, you can take the other sort of attitude, which says, well, I'm not interested in theology, just give me the practice. And in a sense, your practice won't be very reliable if you haven't got the theology to understand why you're doing it, because you won't do it if you don't understand why you're supposed to do it. So what we have in Hebrews is, in fact, 10 whole chapters where the writer is labouring hard. And I can see my voice is labouring hard as well. Let me just have a quick swig of this. And the writer is labouring hard theologically to demonstrate to them that Christ is supreme and that Christ is sufficient. And he takes his time in various different ways to contrast Jesus Christ with things of the law, with things of the old covenant. He says, you know, Christ, he's in a new order. He's in a sort of order of his own. That's the order of Melchizedek, not in the old Aaronic sort of priesthood order. He's different. He's better. He's everlasting. And all of that takes 10 chapters. But then when we get to chapter 10 and verse 19, he says, now therefore, in the light of all this, let's get down to some practicalities. And so that's what we see here, the practicalities starting to come out. And the first of it is to try and restore, to try and put back in its place their confidence. You know, it's very easy to lose confidence. I don't know whether you can ever think back to a point in your life where seriously you lost your confidence. I think we probably all can. At different stages, we are not so confident in life. I suppose in some ways, you know, we get the stuffing beaten out of us Maybe it just comes because of one nasty encounter and we get a bit winded in life and it takes us a long time to get up again, to get back on our feet and to sort of properly recover. Maybe it's just a whole lot of things that all just added up together take it out of us. So yes, it's true that the scenery of our lives can sometimes get a bit dark and we need to have our confidence restored. And that's what we see here in verse 19 where we read this. Therefore, brothers, since we have confidence to enter the most holy place by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way opened for us through the curtain, that is his body. And since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near to God. And these verses should be very important to us. And they're important because they are repeated verses. And it's one of the rules of sort of biblical interpretation. The way you find something repeated, usually it's an indication that it is an emphasis. And we find this here in this letter of Hebrews. And we had it also read to us earlier on, chapter 4, verses 14 through 16. And you'll see there's a very large degree of crossover in these verses here in chapter 4, right at the very end of chapter 4. And they're very well-known verses, and they're good memory verses, in fact. I'll read them. It says here in chapter 4 and verse 14, therefore, since we have a great high priest who's gone through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. For we do not have a high priest who's unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who's been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet was without sin. Let us then approach the throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. We don't probably realise quite how revolutionary this kind of teaching was to the Jews at that time. If you remember the Jews, they had a tabernacle, they had a temple, and in that temple was the sort of the holy place, and then they had the Holy of Holies. And there was a big thick veil, if you remember, that protected that section. And it sort of fenced off God from the people, apart from once in the year when the high priest himself could go in to minister in the Holy of Holies. But here now, in the New Testament, it's all changed, isn't it? On the day that Jesus cried out, "It is finished," at that moment, the veil was torn. That big, thick veil was opened up for us. And a way was opened through the curtain. And is still open today. And will always remain open because Jesus has opened it. And what Jesus has opened, guess what? No man, no one, nobody can shut what he has done. Even Satan can't draw the curtains again into the Holy of Holies. It's kind of an equivalent of saying nowadays, you know, you can just go into number 10. You can just go up Downing Street, knock on the door and just go in. The door's open. You can just go in. And in the first room on the right, Gordon Brown will be in there and you can just go in and have a chat with him. We'd say, no, that's ridiculous. You can't do that. It's similar to them. They would have thought in that sort of way. You can't just waltz into the Holy of Holies. Who are we? I'm not even a Levite. Not even a high priest. It's not even, you know, that Day of Atonement so that the high priest can go in. And of course, the New Testament makes a very revolutionary change that we can approach the throne of grace. And it was a throne, wasn't it? That Ark of the Covenant, that sole piece of furniture within the Holy of Holies, that was like a throne. It had the mercy seat with the cherubim there on the top, where the presence of God came down on that very seat. So it's very, very real, and it should restore to us confidence that we can go into the holy place. There it is emphasized in Hebrews in at least two places that we are to have confidence and we are to approach. So that's the first thing. Let us draw near. That's the first thing I want to sort of anchor in your minds. Let us draw near. And perhaps for this new year, that's one of the things you need to do. You need to do more drawing near to God and to do so with confidence. The second thing is that of holding fast. Verse 23 reads this: let us hold unswervingly to the hope we profess, for he who promised is faithful. A few weeks ago, I played a particularly strenuous game of badminton. And I must confess that I don't play a lot of badminton. And although I kind of got through the game all right and wasn't too sort of puffing and panting at the end of it all, I did discover that when I came home in the evening, I had to write out a card to somebody. And I didn't realise quite why my writing looked like a 99-year-old. It was kind of going like this. And I couldn't figure it out. And then I suddenly realised that all that strenuous exercise on my sort of arm here had caused it to shake and was quite seriously shaking. And you know, there can be times in our lives too when strenuous activity, strenuous work as a Christian can make us a bit shaky. Three times here in this letter at least, we come across an exhortation to remind us about Christ's faithfulness. And coupled with that on each time is that command to therefore hold on. Because Christ is faithful, we must therefore hold on. We must, if you like, retain our grip, restore our grip. Let me give you those three times, and maybe you can find other times where we get the same thing still in Hebrews. The verse is in chapter 3 and verse 6. But Christ is faithful as a son over God's house, and we are his house, if we hold on to our courage and the hope of which we boast. So they have it, the faithfulness and the holding on. Chapter 4 and verse 14. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has gone through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, what are we going to do? Well, let us hold firmly to the faith that we profess. And then chapter 10 and verse 23. Let us hold unswervingly to the hope we profess. Why do we do that? Well, because he who promised is faithful. And so the two things are married together there in the scripture. And you can see it. Very, very clearly. And so the import for us, the importance is that we should retain our grasp, that we should hold fast. The third thing is this. We draw near, we hold fast, we stay put, unswervingly, we hold unswervingly to our faith, to our hope. The third thing is that we must spur one another on. We've been looking so far at the sort of the vertical dimension, the Godward dimension. But there is, of course, a horizontal, a manward dimension. And we need to focus a little bit on this. And I've noticed over the years that there is, if you like, a very selfish variety of Christianity that is emerging. A number of times people say to you, well, look, you know, I'm a Christian, but I don't go to church. And no doubt you've encountered people who say that to you, perhaps on the doorstep, perhaps you know them through your work experience. And these are kind of soul Christians, perhaps Lone Ranger Christians. I don't know what you want to call them. And it's a very contrary thing, isn't it, when you think it through? You know, you've got somebody who maintains that kind of line, and they're saying, you know, I want to avoid God's people. I want to avoid God's people in God's house. I want to avoid God's people in God's house on God's day. I want to avoid all of that. It's kind of crazy that you can have somebody who's part of a family but doesn't want to know the family. Doesn't make sense. A bit of contradiction in terms, isn't it? It was Robert Moffat who wrote the one of the translations of the New Testament, who said that people like this, Christians in isolation, are pious particles. That's what he described them as, pious particles. But we're not meant to be like that. But that's one way that's increasingly popular today. But there's another one that I've noticed. And this is what I call the drive past. The drive past. And what I mean by that is simply that there are many people you discover in one place, and they drive past churches that are evangelical, solidly Bible-centered, loving God, active in outreach and all these different things, and they drive past them in order to go to something which is bigger, better, more well-resourced, less demanding perhaps, and they drive past to go to those churches. Now let me make it clear that it's not wrong in all cases, and I can say that because I've done it myself, and so it's not always wrong to drive past another church. It's not always wrong. And of course, not all churches are good, solid, Bible-centered, God-honoring, God-glorifying churches. There are churches that are really very dead, and I wouldn't encourage you to join those kinds of churches. There has been an article written in the last two editions of Evangelicals Now under the heading of Why Join a Small Church? I want to summarise to you some of the reasons that they put forward, and they're worth bearing in mind. The first is simply because big churches can spare you and small churches probably can't. The second is because small churches give you greater opportunities to serve. Not in all cases, I know, but in many cases that can be the case. If you think of large churches, maybe 100, 200 people, a lot of the positions are filled. And so many, many people are sort of washing around and thinking, well, what can I do? Well, I guess I just attend the meetings, and perhaps there's not so much that you can do in that situation. But in a small church, that situation doesn't tend to arise. You have a small number of people, and so everybody has got a role to fulfill. There's too many jobs for that not to be the case, unless they're simply not willing to take a part. Small churches give opportunities for closer fellowship. To put it another way, you can get lost in a big church, and maybe some people go to big churches exactly for that reason, so that they can be lost, so they can be not noticed in the back, slip out, and nobody will sort of blink an eyelid. It can be a real downside to the big churches that if somebody doesn't turn up for 4 weeks on the trot, nobody might notice. And that's a very sad thing. If people don't turn up here for 4 weeks, you can be sure I'll notice. Everybody will notice if people don't turn up for 4 weeks. Small churches can draw more out of your gifting simply because you are able to exercise your gifting and potentially develop that gifting. Small churches offer potentially a greater significance to your life's work. Because, you know, a small church in some senses bucks the trend. You know, today, small churches, many of them are going under. Dwindling congregations, buildings that are closing their doors for the final time, being bought up as, I don't know, furniture warehouses, or worse still, as nightclubs and things like this. You know, we can, as small churches, we can buck that trend, and we can say to society, no, God is able to do immeasurably more than all we think or imagine, and we're very much alive, thank you very much, and we can buck the trend, and you can be part of that. You know, we invest so much time, don't we, into our careers, into where our lives are going, into maybe our houses, all sorts of different things. And yet, maybe we need to ask ourselves, well, what is my life going to count? At the end of the day, when God, you know, starts to reckon up all the things we've done in our lives, what will we be able to say in regard to his kingdom? Have we built a little section of his kingdom? Have we cultivated an area of God's garden? And so he'll say, well done, good and faithful servant. I saw that area of the garden of my kingdom that you tended and built up and sorted out and chucked the stones out of and made it look good. I wonder whether we'll have things like that. And in a small church, you've got lots of opportunity to do that sort of thing. So yes, small churches have got a lot to offer. Here we are then, at the start of 2008 and the start of our third year. And I look forward to that. I embrace it. And certainly to enable me to embrace it better, I'm going to remember to draw near to God with confidence. I'm going to hold fast to God. And I'm going to do that simply because I know God is faithful. And I'm willing to stand up and say that. God is faithful, and so I'm going to hold unswervingly to that. And also I'm going to take whatever steps I can to stir up one another to love and good deeds, as this passage says. In fact, it says it twice, doesn't it, that we are to encourage. We are to encourage one another. And, you know, we all know, don't we, when somebody comes and gives us a word of encouragement, we kind of are first usually taken aback, because we don't get very many of them normally, and we probably don't give very many of them either. And so one of the things I'm going to try to do this year not sure whether it's as much as a resolution, but one thing I think I'm going to try and do this year is to find ways I can encourage people and say, well, that was really good. I appreciated that. And just take opportunities to stir up one another. Draw near, hold fast, and let's stir up one another in Jesus' name. Amen.